Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. Activist organizations launch wide-scale response to Operation Midway Blitz and the increased ICE presence. Suicide is one of the leading causes of death in the U.S. An event this weekend brings people affected by suicide together and how we can prevent more deaths.
This is the pacemaker. It's about the size of it. Point of reference here is a sesame seed.
And breakthrough bioelectronics that promise to transform the future of medical monitoring technology. First off tonight, federal officials say Operation Midway Blitz has yielded more than 500 ICE arrests in the Chicago area since it began earlier this month, prompting a wave of protests and grassroots organizing. Volunteers from across the city are training to join neighborhood rapid response teams, which respond to reported ICE sightings within minutes. Other organizations have created Know Your Rights campaigns and support networks for undocumented workers. Joining us to talk about all that and more are Baltazar Enriquez, president of the Little Village Community Council, Miguel Alvelo Rivera, executive director of the Latino Union of Chicago, and Berto Aguayo, co-chair of the Latino Leadership Council Policy. Gentlemen, thanks to all of you for joining us and welcome back. Baltazar, let's start with you, because the Little Village Community Council, you all have been handing out hundreds of orange whistles to alert undocumented residents of ICE's presence. How did you all come up with that idea, and how's it been working?
Oh, well, I would like to thank our members, our volunteers, for being out there. We started in June, and originally, when we gave out the whistle, they told us, what are that for? What is that for? And when we met with our brothers and sisters over in L.A., and they said, look, when they're going to deploy the National Guards and ICE agents, they will turn off the cell phone towers. So then we amped up our campaign of letting people know, hey, if you blow the whistle when you see ICE, and those that don't have a legal status, get away, close your doors. And then we got a team of volunteers that actually go where there's ICE agents. They begin blowing the whistle, alerting the community, and they leave. We stopped their operative. We stopped them from doing an arrest, kidnapping a family. So it does have an effect, because it's 3-6 of us blowing this whistle. And it's annoying, but other than that,
I won't ask you to blow it on.
Other than that, you know, they see that the community is organized.
How's it been working? Like, what have you seen? I'm sure it's been used.
So at the beginning, when we were blowing the whistle on ICE agents, they were confused. Why is this guy blowing a whistle? And people started locking doors. People started leaving the block. So they noticed that it's an alert to the community that they are out there, and for them to take the proper steps, because they're not coming for criminals, they're coming for families, they're coming for people going to work, and you know, this is another layer of trauma that they bring to our neighborhood, and that's why our team is always available from 5 a.m. to 7 o'clock at night. That's when they do their operatives, and we're out there every day, just patrolling the neighborhood.
Miguel, at a protest last week, you spoke against ICE targeting undocumented people at places where they work. Here's a little bit of that.
In the last 2 days, ICE has targeted Home Depot corner hiring sites such as this one, where we stand, where day laborers, our neighbors who build, paint, fix, and beautify this city, have been the target of these unwarranted attacks.
How's ICE's presence in communities, in neighborhoods, impacting people's willingness to go to work?
So there is, I think, what feels like an overwhelming sense of concern and fear. But at the same time that exists, I think there is just as much of an overwhelming sense of a need to connect as communities and a need to look out for each other. So I've been able to witness both. And as part of my organization, we've had to navigate both, right? Both recognizing folks' concerns and their fear, but also motivating them to stand up for each other. Because one thing that we know, and one thing that we've always known, is the only people that will keep us safe is ourselves, or like we say, solo el pueblo salva al pueblo.
Mm-hmm. The Latino Union of Chicago, you all set up a volunteer-powered worker support network to empower people to go back to work. Tell us about that and how that works.
Correct. So Latino Union has been organizing for 25 years at the 10 different corner hiring sites in the city of Chicago and now in suburban Cook County. Part of our work has been connecting with day laborers, doing outreach with them, getting them to know their rights, both as workers, but also because many of them can be undocumented, as migrant workers. Now, with the increased presence of ICE at the corners, particularly in other states such as LA, we have been preparing for months to mobilize groups of volunteers. These are community members, people from all walks of life that know these day laborers and are signing up for shifts from 6 in the morning until 2 p.m. and are there to keep an eye out on things and ensure that our working neighbors are just as safe as we all deserve to be safe.
So then should ICE show up outside, you know, day laborers, for example, hanging out outside the Home Depot or Menards, if ICE should show up, mm-hmm. what is the response from those team members?
So we're integrated into the rapid response networks throughout the city. We are connected with the Family Support Network, and then we're also replicating a lot of the tactics that we've learned from our compas in Little Village. It's really a citywide effort, and we are just integrating the aspects of our work, which is day laborers, which is domestic workers, into that broader community effort that's happening throughout Chicago.
Berto, we know that you recently received your law degree from Northwestern. You've been involved in creating some Know Your Rights campaigns for people who are undocumented. Tell us about those campaigns and what folks learn from them.
Yeah, so the idea has been with collaborating with partners all across the city. It's been a citywide coalition, a statewide coalition of just educating community members that they have rights and to know their rights, to exercise those rights, while at the same time asking people who are maybe more protected, if they're U.S. citizens, to exercise their rights. They have the right to film, they have the right to alert community members, and to use our privilege to collectively help each other out and protect one another. There's also an old saying, el pueblo unido jamás será vencido, mm-hmm. the people united will never be defeated, and we all have to do our part to take care of one another. If you have citizenship like me, go out and document these things, alert your community members that ICE may be present, blow the whistle, right? Let people know, and also shop at your local businesses, help them out because they're hurting right now. And so it's a Know Your Rights campaign, but it's also a campaign to exercise those rights and to let people know that we have a beautiful tradition in Chicago of peacefully protesting and peacefully assembling and ensuring that our rights are respected.
The Mexican Independence Day Parade, it kicked off in Little Village early last week, despite that increased ICE presence. Humberto, you were at the parade along with about 30 attorneys.
Yeah.
Why do you all feel that organizing that legal support is important in advance of events like that? And what did it do for the energy of the parade?
Yeah, I think working together with rapid response groups on the scene, you know, it's going to take a collective effort, right? Community residents forming rapid response groups, legal support to document the things that need to be documented, people in Broadview exercising their rights, people in Back of the Yards, people in Elgin coming together and taking care of one another. And what the legal presence does is it allows community members to know, hey, there's attorneys right there. There are people who I can count on, who I can seek advice from, or who I can just lean on to know how to document and to de-escalate a situation. And that's what we did at the Mexican Independence Day Parade. And now we're just planning to use our law degrees and use our legal resources to provide more legal support by deploying attorney volunteers to key communities, to key events, to ensure that we're all doing our part and helping the community out.
Real quick before we go, we've seen some protests across the city. You just mentioned outside the Broadview Detention Facility. Here's a little bit of some of what we've seen.
Oh, my God. 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 Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Oh my God.
A couple seconds, I'm gonna throw this out to all of you. What do you make of ICE's, you know, general use of force? Balthazar.
You know, they're going to try to be as aggressive as they can to show that we will get feared, you know, that fear will enter. And a lot of the neighborhood, like Wayo said, are not coming out. And it's because they've been so aggressive detaining mothers, detaining fathers and in front of their kids. So that's what's
really... Which instills fear, of course, in children, other community members. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Unfortunately, this is something we'll have to keep talking about. My thanks to the three of you. We look forward to having you back. Baltazar Enriquez, Miguel Alvelo Rivera, and Berto Aguayo. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Up next, a major suicide awareness and prevention event coming to Chicago. We have details.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
In 2023, more than 1,500 people in Illinois took their own lives. That's according to the CDC. This weekend, people who have been touched by suicide are coming together to honor the lives lost in a local event. Organizers say it is the largest suicide prevention event in the United States. The Out of the Darkness Chicagoland Walk will also help share information about suicide warning signs and where to find help. Joining us now are Angela Cummings, Executive Director for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention Illinois Chapter, and Sean Connolly, Board Member of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention Illinois Chapter. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So currently, suicide is the 14th leading cause of death in the state of Illinois. Angela, what direction would you say the suicide rate in Illinois is trending? Which way is it going?
Well, it's actually sort of leveling off. So we were fortunate in 2019 and 2020, and we did see a dip in the rates during those years, and then of course the pandemic came along, and then we saw a U-turn, and they did kind of return to the pre-pandemic phases, and so now we're just kind of at a leveling off, which is not where we want to be. We want to bring the suicide rate down, and we know that there are warning signs that there we can observe, and we know there are interventions that anybody can learn, and so we really feel hopeful that we can start to bring this rate down for sure.
To what do you attribute, or what factors can you attribute to when the rate changes the way it did? Obviously, COVID, that is an outlier, right? But
sure.
When it goes up or down, what can you attribute that to?
Well, when it went down, we like to think that it was because of the work that we were doing, educating people about the risk factors, educating people about the warning signs, and then the protective factors that can help people if they are experiencing, you know, a mental health crisis, and then how to get the help. You know, the pandemic was not good for anyone for various reasons. One good thing that did come out of it, though, is telehealth. I will say that was a silver lining. Before COVID, people, insurance companies did not think that you could see a therapist through Zoom, and then that was the only way people could get help, and now suddenly that's how many people get help, and it's much more equitable.
It's very common now.
So, yeah.
Yes. Sean, we know that we lost your sister, Alex, to suicide, and we're sorry for your loss. Tell us more about her, please.
Yeah, my sister died 12 years ago this year, and she had diagnosed bipolar, and I think that's a common thread we see a lot of times in suicide deaths is overwhelming majority of the time, they either have a potentially treatable or diagnosable mental health condition. And she was a loss survivor.
Looking at her now.
Yeah. She had attempted to take her own life once before, so we knew this risk was there. It was 2013. It was a different time. You know, the ACA was just getting rolled out, which ensured that mental health care was held as an essential health benefit on insurance plans. It made it hard for her to maintain consistent access to high-quality care. And I think in the years since she died, I mean, it's brought up so many conversations. I mean, grief is a real complicated emotion. It's a real complicated experience. But for me, it's really brought home this idea of, I don't think before this I ever thought of suicide as a preventable cause of death. You know, we used to say words like, the person committed suicide. You don't say someone committed cancer. You don't say someone committed heart disease. It's the same sort of thing. Trying to figure out the actual root causes that can increase suicide risk and addressing those in a thoughtful and impactful way. And that comes through all sorts of different avenues and ways, but since she died, it's been a really interesting eye-opening experience for me.
Yeah, because you mentioned, your experience with grief, which can be different for everyone, of course. What was your journey like?
Yeah, I think, it's ongoing still. I think, there's always an acute period of time for people where it's really bad, and it's really hurt, and you can have a lot of different emotions. But as you continue on past whatever loss you're grieving, it stays with you. And I think it's something that sometimes we think of as an end point, and I don't think that's always the best way to think about it for folks. I think it's better to think about it like something that you carry with you. It's all your memories and all the love you have for that person. Pre-loss, through the loss, it's all the anger, it's all the sadness you feel. And sometimes you have to engage with the different components of grief, but it's something that it's nice to remember that as you grieve, that means you still have the person with you. That's how I always think about it. And there's no right or wrong way to do it. It's not on anybody's schedule. And sometimes you go a whole year and you don't even think about it. And some years it's like, oh,
this is hard.
Hitting me every day. Yes. So yeah. I really think it's important for people not to have a one-off perspective on it.
Of course. Angela, what are some of the risk factors, warning signs that people need to be watching out for?
Yeah, so risk factors are different than warning signs. And risk factors are kind of those environmental things that might exist in someone's life that could increase their risk. A job loss, a relationship loss, a history of mental illness in the family, an undiagnosed mental illness. And the warning signs are those observable signs that someone may be entering a suicidal crisis moment. And those are typically grouped in talk, behavior, and mood. So, people will talk about it. Their behavior is obviously different. Their mood is different, and it's not going back to baseline. That this is when you want to reach out.
What do you think stops people from getting help?
Well, there are a lot of barriers to care. Cost, for one, stigma. Cultural stigma, for example, can be a big factor, too. There are some communities that think you just need to pray, and prayer is wonderful and a protective factor. But just like any other health condition, if treated properly, you can get better. And so we just want to make sure that people understand that, know how to get to that care, and we can bring down those barriers. Workforce expansion is a huge thing, too. There just are not enough mental health care providers in Illinois and really across the country.
Angela, we know you've got the walk, the AFSP Illinois.
It is.
Chicagoland Out of the Darkness Walk. It's Saturday.
Yeah.
Where does that money go, the money that is raised on that through awareness?
Great question. So AFSP is the largest private funder of research into suicide prevention in the world. So a large chunk of that fundraising goes into research specifically about suicide and suicide prevention and mental health. The rest of it goes to all of our free programs and free resources. We never charge for a program or resources here in Illinois, so we're really lucky that people are so generous and come out to this walk and donate what they can, and it allows us to go out there and do our work, advocacy, education, survivor support, and research, of course.
Sean, of course, suicide can be a very sensitive topic, right? And so you're getting a lot of people together who have a shared experience, right? Describe the mood at the walk for us. What's it like?
The Chicagoland Walk, it's a beautiful day. We do it at Montrose Harbor, so you're right on the lakefront, and there's just a real community of care. So whatever emotion you're coming to the day with, that'll be taken care of. So it can be a deeply, I'm still experiencing a lot of pain. We'll take care of you. It could be a day where I feel good. The sun is up. I'm surrounded by a bunch of other people. We're all feeling what we feel together. And it could just sort of be like a big bear hug, is how I've always described it. When you get out there, it's a couple thousand people. It's just a really beautiful event. And you're surrounded by care, even if you never meet all the people that are caring for you out there. We all have each other's backs. We all understand what everyone else is going through in some meaningful way. And we're very fragile with one another. And I feel like there's a lot of vulnerability out there. This is really beautiful. Okay. It's really great.
And a lot of understanding from people
and a lot of hope. It's such a hopeful event. People just feel so hopeful that they can keep another family from going through that loss, or hopeful they can keep another person from ever reaching that crisis moment.
And you got to have hope. Okay. Well, I hope you all have a good walk on Saturday.
Thank you.
Angela Cummings and Sean Connolly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And if you or someone you know is struggling with depression or suicidal ideation, you can call or text 988 to access the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, or find help online at 988lifeline.org. Up next, scientific breakthroughs in medical monitoring. In a laboratory just north of Chicago, the future of medical monitoring is quietly taking shape. Think flexible electronic monitors the size of a Band-Aid and tiny pacemakers that dissolve harmlessly in the body when they're no longer needed. The work of Querry Simpson Institute of Bioelectronics at Northwestern University at times seems almost miraculous. What makes such breakthroughs possible is a new generation of flexible and, yes, at times dissolvable electronics pioneered by Professor John Rogers. Chicago Tonight producer Paul Kane recently visited with Rogers and his team to learn the secrets of the lab's success.
I've always been interested in how you can connect sort of fundamental scientific research to technologies that have a broader societal impact. I actually got my career start at Bell Laboratories, and so that was where the transistor was invented, the solar cell. So I think it was probably the world's most successful basic science lab in the sense that 10 Nobel Prizes have come as a result of the work that was done there.
Rogers' longtime collaborator and colleague, Tony Banks, explains what makes Rogers different.
What attracted me to start working with him is because his mindset was, you know, hey, we want to make these great gadgets, we want to make these great things, but not for the sake of making them, we want to make a difference in society.
One such invention is the lab's creation of small, flexible health monitors, first developed by Rogers' team for use on premature babies in Lurie Children's Hospital. That technology has since evolved to help babies and pregnant mothers halfway across the globe.
Program managers from the Gates Foundation and the Save the Children organization proactively reached out to us and asked whether we could adopt those technologies for deployment into resource-constrained areas of the globe. That became really an interesting engineering challenge. How do you go from what we originally developed as a single-use, purely skin-like device to something that could be used in Zambia, where the device would have to be reused 1,000 cycles in order to amortize the cost of the device?
Rogers and his team took less than 12 months to come up with an answer.
So the next version of the device that we developed for deployment in the lower middle-income countries, a little bit thicker, more like a Band-Aid rather than a temporary tattoo, but has battery power on board. It also uses communication standards that are compatible with smartphones. So everybody in these countries, they have smartphones. We just use that as the monitor to reduce costs. This was put through FDA approval. It's part of a small startup company in the Chicagoland area that we launched as a result of this opportunity brought to us by the Gates Foundation. The version that's deployed currently has a little bit different form factor, a little bit larger battery, but it's designed to separate to a greater extent the electrodes. We get a stronger electrocardiogram signal, and it sort of wraps around the chest of the infant in this way.
While there are some unique materials used to make the monitors, Rogers says many of the base components are no different to what you might find in a smartwatch.
So the fact that these devices are reusable and wirelessly rechargeable with no external ports that could be contaminated with biofluids and things like that, they can be cleaned. You could just dunk them in an alcohol bath, for example. That's been the real focus, is reuse to hundreds of cycles. So you don't even worry about the cost of the device.
In a tour of the lab, Banks explains how it can rapidly develop and then evolve new devices.
We design, build, make all our own electronics, so a lot of the electronics like this, so this small flexible device you can see here that stretches and molds and can conform to the human body, along with several other devices that you can see here that a lot of these postdocs are working on. And so this is the first step in the process of making those devices. Once you do the design, then this is the prototyping stage where you start building the devices.
One recent invention is the development of a tiny pacemaker for babies that, once implanted, dissolves harmlessly in the body when no longer required, negating the need for additional surgery to extract the device.
This is the pacemaker. It's about the size of it. Point of reference here is a sesame seed here. I always like to put that nearby. This interfaces with the surface of the heart. It's self-powered, so sort of a battery capacity built into the device itself on this side, the sort of cardiac tissue contacting side. And on the other side is a photoactivated switch that we can use to set the pacing rate. It's implantable, so getting through the FDA regulatory process will take some years. But this was just published in April, so it's brand new technology.
But while Rogers' lab may already be creating cutting-edge technologies for the benefit of all, Rogers says his most important legacy will be his students.
If I think about the longer arc of my career, the largest impact that I'm likely to have is via all of the students who've passed through this group and then go on and start their own research groups and join companies and sort of impact the world in that way. So that's my number one focus.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Paul Kane.
And as for those infant health monitors, Rogers estimates that so far about 10,000 devices have been deployed to monitor some 30,000 infants in about 20 countries around the world, as far away, including as far away as Zambia, India, and Brazil. Rogers says the goal is to get 1 million devices deployed to monitor 1 million patients per year. And that's our show for this Tuesday night. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, at WTTW.com/newsletter. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm that gives back to the community through law and philanthropy.